So hi, and welcome to this week's Postcard. I'm Kate Howe, co-founder of Postcards for Parents, and I'm here with Dr. John Stewart, our clinical director. Hi, John.
Hi, Kate. Good to see you.
Nice to see you too. So this week we're talking about parent self-care. That's something that might have felt harder than usual this week in the face of the news of the school shooting in Texas, and that, you know, kind of just feeling a little bit familiar at this point, which is, I would like to say that we're shocked and saddened, but sadly we're kind of less shocked than we used to be about this stuff, and maybe that's more saddening. And as we try to take care of our kids, we also really need to take care of ourselves through these feelings. And so we wanted to tackle some of these questions today with John. So I guess I'd like to start by asking, when awful things happen, how can parents start by processing their own emotions? Part of what we know is that kids are co-regulated by parents. So for parents to be able to help our kids, we have to be in the kind of a decent emotional place ourselves. But what do we do when something like this happens? And that's just really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a really good answer for you, Kate. You know, I can muddle around it because, you know, I, like you, like anybody else who has a sense of just the horror, the tragedy of events such as happened in Texas, there is no easy way through it. I mean, I think people look for cover in different places, some of them probably pretty effective and some of them not so effective. I don't think there's any question in my mind that the cover that we have to seek, it really, there's two parts to it. And part of it is the emotional response, and then the other is kind of the rational response, you know, kind of the narrative, right? How do I understand this? How do I go forward? How do I bolster myself against the fear that moments like this bring up in me as a person or as a parent? I think from, you know, the emotional side of it is we've got to feel it. We've got to let it be a part of us. Now, denial for some folks is a little more effective than others. The dilemma with denial is that it oftentimes postpones the processing of whatever it is to a later point. It also leaves us alone with the difficult emotions. I think it also gets in the way of our learning from the experiences. So it's not to say that denial as an initial, you know, response is a horrible thing. I think if you're a first responder, you need to dissociate. You need to disconnect from the emotion and just do what you have to do. That's healthy. That's what you have to do. But if you're not a first responder and you're just somebody such as us who is there, you know, not needing to do anything other than to figure out what to do with the sadness and to some extent, the fear that comes with this, then I think we've got to talk about it. We've got to feel it. I think we've talked before about the two types of strength. There's the strength of the oak tree, you know, that can take a wind up to, you know, 150 miles an hour and it stands strong, but at 151, it's gone. And there's the strength of the willow that bends at 5 miles an hour, but at 151, when it stops, it comes back up. I mean, I really believe that it is the strength of the willow that our hearts most respond to. It is okay to feel lost and sad and scared. I told you a little earlier that I was riding the elevator, a small elevator in my office, up to my office yesterday. There was a young man on the elevator, and I said something kind of playfully to him, and I didn't know him, but he just looked sad. And I said to him, I said, your heart looks pretty heavy, buddy. And he looked at me and he said, you saw the news? I said, yeah, I saw the news. And he said, my wife's an elementary school teacher. And he just began to cry. And I can't imagine a better response, because he couldn't help but to feel it together. Certainly I felt it with him, believe me. I was feeling it before, but in that moment. And so that's the way that we take these experiences and we process them together. You know, that's really number one. We then maybe, depending on the nature of your kind of spiritual self, you may go out and look at the ocean, look at the stars, and ask the universe to care for us, these little ones and these families, and to give us courage and love or whatever the hell it is that gets us through this stuff. Or maybe you have a more traditional faith that I think there's a spiritual component to this, whether it's in more traditional religious pathways or ones that are really just more tied to a sense of connection with all that's around us. So yeah, I think we breathe, we slow down, we feel it with one another, we give ourselves the right to feel sad, and then we try to move forward. And I think that unfortunately, we have a whole lot of folks who manage these kinds of situations by putting it into a narrative that puts them in a stance where they need to be the oak tree, and little wisdom or compassion comes out of that. And so we're a culture that's trying to figure out how to be who we are in a way with some kind of grace. And we're not always great at any of us. We all have our bad moments, that's for sure.
At the risk of getting a little bit too analytical, because I can tend to do that, and I know this is maybe not the time, but it is helpful for me to kind of hear the different ways that people cope, just to be able to kind of recognize that when I might tend to go there myself or kind of see that in other people. So, you know, you mentioned denial is one way. Are there and then feeling together as a more healthy way? Are there other things to kind of look out for that you see people do?
Absolutely. I talked about there's the heart side and then the rational side, or we can say the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, you know, however we want to talk about that. And I think that, you know, another thing that we can do, because this activates both sadness and fear. Experiences like this, we see ourselves in them. We see ourselves in these parents. We see our kids in these little ones that lost their lives. And that elicits fear. And so how do we manage the fear? And I think one of the ways we manage the fear, and I think it's good, but it's not just this. It's not just this rational way that we manage it, but it's the rational and the emotional side. But the rational side is oftentimes talking ourselves through the fact that we don't have to be so afraid. We may feel compulsion to bear witness and have empathy for the folks who are going through this, but statistically, it's a lot like getting on an airplane. In reality, it's probably, you know, and most of us have a rational side that says, all right, I understand the odds that I'm going to get to where I'm trying to go. My airplane's not going to go down. But I also understand it can happen. But I'm not going to have my readiness for disaster dial up my lower brain and have me operating in this kind of anxious, frightened mode that is not adaptive. And there are even those, and I don't know about this, but it's kind of an interesting thought. There are those who believe that which we look for, we will see. And that it is possible that when we're really frightened and anxious, we actually can draw ourselves towards seeing those things that affirm that and pull us in. I mean, I don't want to get too far deep into the whole magical notion about all that stuff, but I don't also want to say there's nothing to it. You know? Mm-hmm. I think there is something to it. And so I know that what we look for, we do tend to see. And what we see, we tend to go towards. I think I've told you before that I've had the responsibility for kids and grandkids to be the one to teach them to ride a bike. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, the most important thing you can teach kids in that process from a mind stance is look where you want to go. Because if you look where you want to go, you'll go there. Mm-hmm. If you look at what you're afraid of going towards, whether it's the ground or the wall or the car that's parked there, you'll go towards it. Mm-hmm. You will. And then, you know, all of these kids who I've taught, I'm certain it's echoing in their heads. Look where you want to go. Don't look at the wall. Don't look at the ground. You know, because I absolutely believe that it is one of the most important aspects of freeing your body away from the fear to a place where it knows how to take you. Mm-hmm. I believe that there are many things in life that are like that we have to acknowledge. We have to acknowledge the hard and sad things, but we also have to work at moving towards gratitude and moving towards the things that provide us some sense of hope, safety, all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, events like this are horrible in the moment, but I think they also can kind of reactivate old triggers and fears. And tell me about that. Like what should we, how does that work, and what should we do about that?
I mean, I think that's a wonderful point, Kate, that we all have a reserve of old hurts, of old fears, of old losses, tragedies, whatever. We all have that. And you're absolutely right that when things like this come up, it taps into that ancient reserve. I mean, I think other than to be aware of it, that's probably the most important thing, that in those moments, we're not just feeling that moment. Not that moment isn't enough to feel, but it does take us to other places. And once again, if we're lucky enough to have loved ones, friends, therapists, the sky, a kind dog, just to share it with, to share the fact that it's not just this moment. It's all that it is, the existential reality of the fragility of our lives and the past losses that we've had to make our way through, some of which maybe we haven't fully moved ourselves through. There is even kind of a strange kind of opportunity associated with these sort of things, because it will bring up old stuff. And that, you know, old stuff sometimes gets packed away in a way that it just keeps processing, not necessarily in a positive way. And sometimes things like this do allow us to bring it up and to think about it and talk about it and share it with others. So yeah, I don't think there's any question that all trauma, loss, those sort of things, they dip down into old things and have a way of bringing some of them up.
Mm-hmm. And if you can kind of do with this what you're recommending, process it together, kind of feel those feelings, that is, you know, if nothing, even if you're not particularly working on old traumas, I would say at least knowing that you can get through something breeds confidence.
Sort of absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Each time we confront, I mean, I think about, you know, trauma surgeons and people who just repeatedly, first responders, who repeatedly find themselves in these moments where they're exposed to the fragility of life and to tragedy, and that you know, they do have to experience on some level, or they lose their humanity, in which case that's not good. But I have known many who that has deepened them. And they don't live their lives in fear. So I think it is a strange kind of opportunity. Mm-hmm. There is depth in it. There's depth in pain.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I was just talking to a friend who was going to wake for a childhood friend. So this was a different tragedy from the national one. But she mentioned, you know, it makes you aware, appreciative of the life that you have, aware how fleeting it is. And that sort of seems like what you're talking about, that you can live actually with more appreciation. With that awareness.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. That there is a window there that deepens us in, mm-hmm. in a good way.
Do you have any tips of how to open that window?
How to open that window? Be present. You got to be present. I've had the kind of sad reality on a few occasions to kind of go down the path with children with terminal illness, and it's being present. And I will tell you, I am grateful for those experiences I had. They're heartbreaking. And I am grateful for what it is that these kids allowed me to do together with them. You know, how they have to figure it out. They have to, and oftentimes children and adults, but not all adults, end up making that journey without fear. Or with limited fear, not without fear. I don't know anybody goes without fear, but with limited fear. And there is something about that. So I say when you're exposed, when you have the opportunity to be in the presence, not to fix, not to heal, not just to be together with persons who are experiencing loss, go towards it. I do think it's one of the things that deepens us, but only if we go towards it with our hearts open, which means we feel it together with them. And we grow from that.
Well, thank you. That seems like a slight silver lining in the...
It is a slight, I think there's a slight silver lining.
All right, last question is, we're talking really about parents and processing our emotions, because that is when we do that, then we're automatically more able to help our kids. But how would you recommend handling emotions if you're feeling them when you're with your kids, or if they kind of, you know, witnessing you having big emotions?
Yeah. I think that's a great question. I think that two things. I think that the age of the child is a variable. With little ones, if you can protect them from the knowledge of an event such as this, I would do it. But you oftentimes can't. And if they ask about it, then you got to go. You got to go there. And when you go there, you need to go with both a narrative and your emotion. But the emotion has to be somewhat padded, because if we are feeling despondent in response to this, our despondency, our kids are not going to be able to process effectively. Mm-hmm. Our sadness, they can. Despondent means I'm no longer really in a position to be able to take care of you. Mm-hmm. And our kids have to have a sense that even if we're sad, really sad, we can still take care of them. We can still do that. Because if kids have a sense that we are not available, and we see that whether it's not available because of mourning or depression or substance abuse or whatever the variable is, if we're not available, it generates such anxiety in kids that they move in some pretty awkward and oftentimes maladaptive, well, perhaps adaptive to the reality in which they're in, but maladaptive with respect to what we would hope they would be able to do if they were in a situation that was better suited to what their needs are. So, you know, I think you have to be a little careful about that. But if your narrative is not congruent with your emotion on some level, mm-hmm. it doesn't go in. It doesn't provide the kids a chance, because we're always looking to do two things with any event in our lives, particularly trauma. We're looking to have an emotional kind of resonance with it, and we find our place in motion. We're looking to create a narrative. Hmm. We want both of those. That's that integration of those two is what allows us to move through things. And so, you know, if we offer a narrative and there's no emotion, it's hollow. Mm-hmm. If we offer emotion and there's no narrative, it's hollow. It's not organized.
It's scary.
It's scarier. That's right.
And also, if we offer a narrative that doesn't match up with the emotion that they're perceiving, then it's gaslighting and confusing.
Yeah. Any of those three bad choices, which we all can go towards from time mm-hmm. to time. So be gentle on yourself as a parent. You know, you're going to have to, you may be despondent for a day, or for you come back and you say, you know what, you fix it, you make a repair. So, I'm sorry. I know that it may not have seemed like mom could have even taken care of you then, but I could have. If you really needed something, I would have done it. I want you to know mm-hmm. that. You go back and you make repairs. Yeah, any of those three not great options, leave the child alone. And we don't want that. Mm-hmm.
You touched on this a little bit, but with young kids, try to protect them from the knowledge. How does it kind of change as kids get older?
Well, I think as kids get older, they're going to have the information from their community. And they're also move into a place where they have greater capacity for abstraction. It's going to bring up more existential issues in kind of conscious or preconscious ways. Like, what's the meaning of life? What's this, you know, what's this all about? I mean, does anything matter? You know, it's just, and so, you know, young adolescents and bright kids, actually, it's a little harder for them in some respects, because they have more complex set of variables to manage. Kids who are not particularly, you know, I'm not really talking about IQ, but kids who don't really think about life in particularly deep ways, it is a little bit easier. And all kids think about life in some deep, I don't mean to dismiss and say, oh, it's a dichotomy. It's not, but there are varying degrees by which to which kids are drawn into deeper levels of experience of existential issues. So, you know, I think it's not different in a lot of ways. If your kids got the information, then you walk beside them. You know, there's an old Milton Erickson notion that if you want to get a man to talk about his brother, talk about your brother. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it may well be that if you get a sense they want to, but they don't have the language, they don't know what to do, then to do a monologue about mm-hmm. your own reaction to it. That's part of how we give kids emotional language. Mm-hmm. They see us kind of offering, well, this is kind of what I'm feeling and thinking. Mm. You know, maybe you're the same, maybe you're not. You always want to be humble and not say, oh, you're obviously feeling. And they may say, no, I'm not feeling any of that. And then you go, okay, well, they don't want to feel any of that. That's where they are right now, and that's okay. But giving kids emotional language is a part of helping them learn how to share things. There's a relatively rare, well, it's not that rare. Alexithymia is a clinical term for the inability to be able to label emotion with language. And that's a continuum. There are kids who are amazing at it and kids who are not very good at it. There are adults who are amazing at it and adults who aren't very good at it. So, I mean, I do think that finding words to help describe complex emotional feelings is helpful. I mean, it's why we're drawn to poetry. It's why we're drawn to song lyrics. Mm. It's because, oh, they resonate with us. Oh, my goodness. They get it. I get what they get. We get it. Both of us.
And that's interesting, because I've heard and read a little bit of debate around labeling feelings, in that it is helpful to help bring the feelings into the kind of narrative and cognitive mind, which helps process them. But also sometimes it can take you away from feeling the feelings. But what you're saying is actually more interesting, which is that like nuanced labels actually help us feel the feelings, because they sort of put a finger on something that we didn't really know we were feeling.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And put a finger on it and figure out how to share it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's both.
I love that. All right. Well, thank you so much. This is, again, you know, a topic that it's too bad that we have to discuss, but I'm glad to do it with you.
I'm glad to do it with you as well, Kate. You're always, your questions and thoughts and your piece of this is always so appreciated. All right.
Thank you. Likewise, John. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.